In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, beginning in verse 2, there are a series of couplets going down through verse 8 that we began our study on last week. What he refers to as time-measured events. Of course, what we are concerned with are circumstances that exist without respect to God or without God in the picture, that as a result of that, they are things that happen here on this earth during our lifetime. And if you'll begin reading with me again in verse 1 and going down through verse 8. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. So those are the couplets, very famous portion of Scripture. I know much about it. We have been discussing these, and just because there's so many of them, it takes a little bit of time. Not intending to spend a great deal of time on each of them, but we got to the last four, which start in verse 7, a time to tear and a time to sow, which is at the top of the 13th page in our book. And I just got a message from Tracy. Tracy's got a flat tire.
She had
a flat
yesterday.
Tire yesterday. Yeah.
That was yesterday's message then.
No, it was just now. I got a flat tire and Brad accidentally took the truck key, I guess. I'll be there when I can find the key. I'll move some other cars to get to another one. she's efforting trying to get here, put it that
way. She's been going back roads somewhere. We need to check on her. Make sure she's really been working or what.
Well, anyway, so that's just let you know that that's why she's not here right now.
I know she's not changing.
Okay, so a time to tear apart and a time to sew together. His only insight on that, of course, he's been pretty concise with regard to these, is that some things can be mended and some things can't. Makes sense. And what we've been trying to do with each of these couplets is to give some application, if we can, of a spiritual nature. And I must admit to the fact that I have a hard time coming up with something. The thing that always comes up to me is the idea of a relationship, that sometimes there is sufficient damage to a relationship that it's hard for it to be patched up. But I don't know that that's really an attitude that we should be having toward our relationships. If we're the ones responsible, the idea is, well, we just can't get along, let's go our own way. That's certainly not applicable to us as Christians. There is that responsibility that we have to heal. So practically, I understand that is the case, that sometimes circumstances arise to where you can't fix it, so it's best just to start over and tear it down and start over. And there are a lot of applications we can give. Does anyone, though, have a spiritual insight with regard to that one, or do we just go on to the next?
Not even doing that one.
No, I'd say, I'm thinking, again, it's not necessarily necessary that we have that with each, because he is basically talking about the circumstances of life. Typically, there are some spiritual applications that can be discerned from that, and the three others at the end are certainly ones that we can make note of. But
what we say sometimes, I mean, you know, what comes out of our mouth, you could tear somebody down.
So we could at least say that, is say, recognize this, that you can act in such a way as to cause irreparable harm. And sometimes you can destroy something entirely to where it's not fixable. And so there's a reason to be careful with regard to your words or your actions. So there would be at least that. But this is stating, basically, is that those things do happen. And we recognize that when it comes to darning socks. Sometimes you can fix the holes, sometimes the holes, there are more holes than there is cloth, and you just have to start over. And you guys maybe know that. I don't know how to sew, but
we don't fix socks anymore.
Yeah, I know. That's what you hear, darning socks. Too easy to go to Walmart and buy another pair, but But, you know, sometimes things just can't be mended. Okay, the last three, though, I think we can make a bit more of a spiritual application to these. A time to be silent and a time to speak. He says, I often get this timing backwards. Do you? And that's the idea. Sometimes we put a foot in our mouths. And that's very possible to do that. So there are a number of applications that can be made. The first and obvious one that you know you might think about that actually probably is not the central point of what he's making is that God has given certain responsibilities to certain individuals. Women keeping silent in the church would be an example of that. There are times when it would be inappropriate for one to speak because it's another's place. But here I think we can make an application with regard to a circumstance that might arise. Let's say it's someone who's in mourning, something troublesome has happened. And one of the things we need to recognize is that there is not always something you can say in order to make it better. And sometimes words actually can be more troublesome than just being there and being quiet. And sometimes the best thing you can do is just commiserate instead of try to make it better. That's not an easy thing for some people to do. They talk about that with difference between men and women. Of course, is stereotypical, but whenever a woman is complaining about a circumstance, the man's response typically is to try to fix it. When what the woman wants is sympathy. And it may be just the opposite. A man's complaining about a particular circumstance and the woman's offering sympathy. He doesn't want sympathy. He wants her to tell him how to fix it. And so there can be that difference between men and women stereotypically. But sometimes the words, it's not a time for words. Sometimes it's a time just to be quiet and to commiserate. Other times it may be that it's unwise to speak because you may exacerbate a situation. Count to 10 before you speak if you're angry, those kinds of things. So, in talking about just wisdom with regard to our behavior with our mouth, the tongue is a member that causes great destruction, as James indicates, and it's the one that's most difficult to control. And if we do come to that understanding that sometimes it is best not to speak, and we reach a time when we have discernment to know when those times are, when something should be said, when you should not say anything, that can cause that can help a great deal, keep us from causing problems. Yeah.
I think that's another difficult thing too, because if someone is in pain in the morning, you feel like personally that you need to say something, you really need to, you know, commiserate in some way. But I know that you're right. What you're saying, it's just.
Well, that's something I found out as a preacher pretty early on, is that sometimes there's no fix.
It didn't really help.
There's nothing you can say
that. You're on both ends.
Yeah.
People offer. You have to realize that too. If you're
sure.
On the receiving end.
You're on the receiving end. But again, sometimes when a person is in dire straits, a very very difficult time. Those kinds of things just cause more anguish. Those efforts. You should do this or you should do that when they're incapable of doing anything. Sometimes maybe what you say too, and I understand that, but I'm just pointing out the fact that we can make a problem worse by our words, and sometimes it's best to remain silent. It's better to be silent and be thought a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. So
you can always just hug them and say, I'm praying for you, or I'm hurting with you. Be careful not to say, I know what you're going through, unless you've actually gone through it. Sometimes you want to say, I understand, or I'm empathizing, and really, you know.
You have no way. Yeah.
Exactly.
Sometimes just being there with them and not saying anything, just your presence.
Yeah, it's just recently had a conversation with an individual where the problems of that person's life was laid out to me as to what, and they were looking for some guidance, and there was some guidance that could be supplied. In fact, I used this text Ecclesiastes to point that out, is that, hey, life's not fair, Certainly not, but there is fairness in judgment, fairness in the end. And sometimes we need to be mindful of that. But I told that person, I said, I wish that I had the magic words that would fix the problem. But there is no real fix to that problem. It is what it is. And there's a part of this particular lesson toward the end that we're going to emphasize, and that is, I think we might have touched on it last week as well, but he says on a couple of occasions here in this book that you cannot change your lot in life, but what you can change is your attitude. And there's some truth to that. When we say you can't change your lot, some people would object to that, thinking that, well, yeah, there are things that you can make, lifestyle changes that you can make, or other things that you can do. An uneducated worker that's not making much money can go get a degree and get a better job. You know, there are things that you can do. But the fact is that it doesn't matter how rich, and this is the point he's making, doesn't matter how rich you are, how poor you are, how smart you are, how uneducated you are, whether you're a man or a woman, what your, you know, culture is or not, the same thing happens to everyone. We live, we die, we have good times, we have bad times, we have times of sickness, times of health, and then that's the end of it. And that happens to everybody. But there are a lot of people that are much happier in their lives than others. And the interesting thing about it is there are a lot of people who have this peace that we are called upon to have, the peace which passes understanding, whose lives are extremely difficult. Whereas there are individuals whose lives are in pretty good shape, they're just miserable. And it all has to do with the attitude. And the spiritual principles behind that, how it is that we can attain a good attitude, and what does that attitude spring from, and the benefits that we have as Christians, that's all a part of it. But that's the kind of the message of the book, is life is vain, the man's despairing, until he comes to the conclusion that the important thing in life is to serve God. And that makes all the difference, and it certainly can. So anyway, so there's sometimes no fix for the circumstances of life. And so when an individual is in distress because of it, the despair is overwhelming, the wound is fresh, then in times like that, sometimes just being there is the best thing that you can do. Because trying to talk them out of it is sometimes the difficult thing, and destructive, detrimental. So a time to be silent and a time to speak. Next one, a time to love and a time to hate. Now, the word hate is an ugly word, and it's a word that is not acceptable in our day and time.
We should always hate sin.
Okay.
Hate sin, so.
Yeah, and that's the point that he makes. Some things we should hate. For example, we should hate what God hates. God hates sin, God hates unrighteousness. So there are certain things that are appropriate to hate, to despise. The Christian is not characterized as being a hateful person. And even in our hating of something, our demeanor and actions don't change in the sense of our seeking the welfare of others and being peaceable with all men. So it's one thing to combat sin and to hate sin. It's another thing to be a divisive individual, a hateful individual. And sometimes people have a problem with making that distinction, but it's there. And it's something we should work at. So when we talk about a time to love and a time to hate, circumstances as well, when you've heard the phrase, and it's cliche, so it's something that people sometimes even resent, but there's truth to it. And that is that you hate the sin and love the sinner. And that's an example of what we're talking about. So there are individuals who think that's ridiculous and an absurd statement. But when you consider eternity, you have an individual who is in sin, his soul is in danger, he stands condemned before God. You desire to bring him back to repentance that his soul might be saved because you love the sinner. But that requires you condemning the sin. And that's hating the sin, loving the sinner. And the world doesn't like that expression at all. But it is a valid one, and one that's appropriate from what the Bible reveals about loving your fellow man, is hating their sin. So, just something to keep in mind. I had to start beside that one because I think that's an important one to note.
Well, and also today, people, they think... love and acceptance are the same thing. You know, well, if they're doing this and I don't approve of it, so, you know, I'm not going to be around them, but...
I agree with that, and you know in the extremes you can see the invalid nature of that, because you'll have a serial murderer, a psychopath that has murdered people and he's in prison, he's on death row or whatever, and you interview his parents. Well, they don't approve of what he's done at all, but they still love him. You know, that's something that doesn't go away. That love is still there, though they're appalled and distressed and disagree with. And maybe when they found out his tendencies, expelled him from the house because of whatever the case may be, it didn't change the fact that they loved him. And we can recognize that. But the problem is with regard to general sin that now is tolerated by society, like homosexuality and other things, to where individuals, when you say, no, we're not going to tolerate that, we don't accept it, but we love the person, then they say, nah, that's not right, you're not loving them, when in fact you are. And the reason why that comes is because the majority of society believes whatever it is we're talking about, whether it be sexual immoralities or alcoholism or whatever the case may be, that these things are tolerated by society. Some things are considered to be actually acceptable. Others, more of a health condition than an actual sin in the minds of many. So in their minds, when you're rejecting their sin, you're rejecting them and not loving them, and that's not the case. So we identify what sin is in Scripture and hate what God hates. But God loves man. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, so we should love man as well and be active in trying to bring them to Christ. Okay, and then the last one in the couplets is a time for war and a time for peace. And he makes an interesting point here, and that is sometimes if it were not for war, there would be no peace. And you've got your hawks and your doves politically in any nation. It certainly is the case in the United States. You have individuals who will talk about the warmongers in one party, and then there are others who will say that appeasement doesn't work. And each have their advocates. I don't know how many times over the years I have heard of the ineffectiveness of Neville Chamberlain when he came back from appeasing Hitler and said, peace in our time. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, the tanks are crossing, I think, the Czechoslovakian border, and Hitler was on his way to dominance. Because of appeasement, that was what he was looking for, is just a little bit more time to put his war plans into motion. And sometimes force must be met with force. But then there are others who would advocate that, you know, like George Bush went to war basically as vengeance for his father and put us in the second desert war because of that reason, with no just cause. Too quick off the... So there's also those kinds of things going on. And there's arguments to be made on both sides, and most probably a lack of wisdom seen by men in these situations quite often. But having said that, there's a spiritual application to this that I think is more important to us, and that is that sometimes there is the necessity to stand for principle in opposition to those who are violating a scriptural principle. And we're going to actually have in our lectureship in less than 2 weeks now, we're going to be... Discussing controversy among God's people. And what we're focusing on is the controversies that have impacted us in the time in America, as Christians in America. And that period of time runs from about the mid-19th century, the 1850s on until today. And we're going to be talking in Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday about issues that trouble brethren even today: institutionalism, marriage force, remarriage, and fellowship. But I, in my lesson on Sunday evening, and I'm going to talk about missionary society, instrumental music, premillennialism, maybe the Grace Unity Movement of the 1970s. Some of you may not be too familiar with that one, but these are issues that come along. Now, let me give you an example with regard to premillennialism, so you can illustrate my point. Premillennial doctrine is something that's very, very prevalent among evangelicals in the religious world today. The idea that Christ is going to come back and reign on his throne for 1,000 years. before the world comes to an end and establishes kingdom. Most brethren, as they came out of the denominations, as like Alexander Campbell, Barton W. Stone, and others, they had some vestiges of their theology that it took a while for them to get rid of. And one of those theologies was premillennialism. And so late 1800s into about 1915, there were a lot of people had the view that that's really not a matter that impacts your salvation. You can be premillennial, postmillennial, amillennial, whatever it is you want to be. And you can still have fellowship and be brethren. Well, then there was a man by the name of R.H. Bowell who became pretty influential, was a writer for, I think, the Gospel Advocate, and a pretty capable individual who held premillennial views and felt like that we didn't do enough preaching on prophecy and we needed to really begin to preach more on it. And so he started doing it, and he was premillennial. And some of the preachers, in dealing with that, they said, you know, we wish that he wouldn't preach so much on prophecy because, you know, we need to tell people now how to be saved. And this premillennialism has nothing to do with telling someone how to be saved. But there were a few others that said, listen, this is error. And this is going to impact our understanding of the nature of the church, understanding the nature of the kingdom. And this is not something that can be going challenged. So Foy Wallace Jr., who's another name no one's familiar with, he met it head on, and they had several debates, and he wrote a big book. It's in our library. It's about this thick on premillennialism and other theories that are unscriptural, and kind of spearheaded a fight against premillennial error in the church. Well, as a result of that, though I think most probably in the institutional churches, there is a vestige of premillennialism that exists. By and large, it's not found among faithful brethren at all. I mean, in non-institutional churches, because brethren have come to understand and recognize that that is error, and they will not have fellowship with it. And so, where it has impacted all of these religious denominations, and where it's a very popular theory and culture, it hasn't impacted the church because men have stood up and fought that fight. And because they fought that fight, that's not an issue that is really troubling brethren today. So because war was fought, peace is possible. And that's kind of one of the points that I want to make to introduce the series in the morning, is that we don't like controversy. The controversy has always existed. And the way to have peace is to basically to throw that error out, to fight against it and to defeat it. So sometimes it is necessary. And so what is our attitude? Boy, I'm preaching this. You're going to have to listen to it again when I preach on Sunday in a week. But as a result of that, what is our attitude toward the controversy? Is it something we don't want to hear? Or is there something we're wanting to listen to make sure that we've got the truth? What do we feel? How do we feel about the ones who are standing in the breach and proclaiming the truth and contending for the faith? Does it make us uncomfortable? Do we consider them too pugnacious? Do we wish that he would stop talking about those things and talk about something more pleasant? Or do we appreciate the efforts of those men who recognize the error and try to stop it? Foy Wallace Jr. became very, very unpopular for what he did. There are a lot of people that just upheld his hands and said, way to go, and supported him, and others that joined in the fight. But his name was mud among many, many brethren, but simply because he was not willing to go along and get along. He knew it was error. He knew it was going to corrupt the church, and he wouldn't let it happen. Not on his watch. As best as he could, he was going to deal with it. But he did a great service to God's people, because that error is not the problem that it is in other places.
But if you don't preach and teach on it, it will happen again.
Sure. And that's why it's necessary. And in fact, that's why the elders decided that this would be an appropriate topic, even though many in the congregation will have heard it again and again and again and again. I mean, lessons on institutionalism. Many of y'all grew up listening to those things. Because the institutional issues had their beginnings in the 40s. And and 30s as far as the beginnings of those things and the discussions of them. But there is a generation here that just, they don't hear it often. I won't say they don't hear it at all. If they're listening to my preaching, they get some of it. But having a lectureship just given to over to that, I know for a fact that we did send out the notices. There are going to be people when they get those notices, they put them up on the board or the announcement, and they're going to look at it and say, why are they talking about that? But there's wisdom in that because there is a generation that needs to hear it that may not have heard it or not as often. Not as grounded as they should be. But that's the application I wanted to make to this particular point, and that is that sometimes you have to fight a battle in order for there to be peace. And as much as this is possible, live peaceably with all men, but if they bring in the error, you have to withstand them. Okay. Doesn't mean it's all right to fight all the time, and that fighting is justifiable. It doesn't mean that anything goes in the fight either, because I've seen individuals who are standing for truth who act very uncharitably and wrong in their defense of truth. Because you can go about it in the wrong way, but it does recognize that there is sometimes that need. Yes.
When Joe's mother died several years ago, and we had her down here a year and a half, 2 years, and took her back to Missouri to bury her, and she'd been down here, and we couldn't find a preacher, but his cousin found someone up there. I don't remember who it was, but her funeral was preached on this what we've been going on.
Okay.
He did a wonderful job.
Good job.
He didn't know her from anything, but he did a very good job.
Well, that's good. That's good. It's a full and helpful text. I mean, it's of course, again, it's well known. Unfortunately, the greatest reason why that's the case is because of the song that we mentioned, the birds singing that song. But the insight here is very good. All right, anybody have any questions, comments about the couplets? It took a while for us to get through them, but good stuff there. The remainder of this particular section, going through the rest of the chapter, he makes a couple of, I think, important points in here that we'll go over. The next section is verses 9 and 10. Actually, 9 through 15, but he breaks it up into two points. And so in 9 and 10, the question is, what profit has the worker from that in which he labors? And then, I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. So these are two questions that he derives from these things. The first one's obvious in verse 9, the second one not so much in verse 10. First one is, what's the profit? So we're talking about work. When a man works and he labors, what profit is that? And again, keeping in mind the theme of the book and the principles that we have established, he points out that if God is not in the picture, then there is no profit. You work hard and you die, and you can't take it with you. That's ultimately the point that is made. So if you view that life without God in the picture, then there's no perspective. He makes this point. I like this middle sentence in the paragraph. Oh, I'm sorry, it's the next section down. So he says, without God, times to laugh seem empty, times to mourn seem go on to forever, because the futility of living life without respect to God. And again, people can get beat down by the labor of life, how difficult it is to get by day. And if there is nothing on the other side, it can become difficult to go on. So that's the point. Second point is, what is the purpose? And he says, I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. Where is life going? Solomon observed all of this and is left with a question mark. And so the point here is, there's no answer necessarily given in this particular verse. It's just an observation. I have seen the God-given task. I've gone through. I acknowledge and see what it is that men are given to do as they live on this earth. And he, at this point, is not giving a full answer as to why these things are important. Up to now, our discussion has been that these things primarily can be understood as vain. Now, when I say that the point of view of the book begins in chapter 1, goes all the way to the end of the book until the last few verses, and it said, life is vain, life is vain, life is vain. There's legitimacy to that point, because it starts off in chapter 1 in verses 1 and 2, where the preacher says, Vanity of vanity, all is vanity. And then in chapter 12 and verse 1, which is the last chapter of the book, we're not there yet, we're only on chapter 3. But you get all the way to chapter 12 and verse 1, he says, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. So his primary purpose from chapter 1 all the way toward the end of the book is to talk about the vanity of life. And he does that well. But there are things that are interspersed within that despairing diatribe that he writes in those first 11 chapters, to where there is some insight and some, in other words, he kind of gives us a foreshadowing of what the end's going to say. And here in verses 10 through 15, or verses 11 through 15, there is some insight that he brings in that kind of speaks toward what he states without exception in chapter 12, verses 12 and 13, that fearing God and keeping his commandment is man's all. So notice in verse 11, going down through verse 15 of Ecclesiastes 3, he said, he's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken away from it. God does it that men should fear before him. That which has already been and what is to be, let me state that again, verse 15, that which is has already been and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. So God's in this section. He specifically makes reference to God in this particular section, and so it's right that he titles this in the book A Moment of Insight. So there are certain things that you can learn based upon what he's talked about up to this point. And the first thing is in verse 11. There are three parts to it. First of all, that everything is beautiful in its time. And this is the perspective that was missing just in the previous verse. So what's the purpose? All of these things that happen. Why did these things happen? What's the purpose of our life? He has made everything beautiful in his time. He's giving some insight with regard to this. And I like that statement in the paragraph, is that only God gives perspective. He puts the missing pieces of the puzzle together. That life viewed from the long lens of his perspective takes on beauty that we rarely see in the moment. Now, the interesting thing about perspective, and I come across this photography. I used to do a lot more photography than I do now. There are several in our member among our members, Josh Scroggins and Armando Vera, both very talented photographers. I know the mechanics of it, but I can't get the creativity down that they do. But there's an interesting thing about a portrait lens that is used in these cameras. When you have a landscape picture, for example, you want a wide angle lens, and you take a picture of a landscape. You say a sweeping mountain vista, for example. And what that does is that puts everything's into focus, and there's a lot there because it's such a wide angle. And so it's difficult to focus on. I mean, if someone has the ability to use wide angle lens and have you focus on one part of the picture, then they've got talent, because that's a difficult thing, because everything is in focus and there's so much of it. On the newest iPhones, they've come out with what they call portrait mode. And they had this in previous iterations, to where you take a picture and it automatically blurs the background, and the only thing that's in focus is your subject. But now they've got filters to where you can actually black it out. You've seen the pictures where you've got a person standing basically in front of a black background, and all it is them. And that's like, well, I could take a picture of any of you right now with that film, with that camera and that filter, and it would look like that, where it's just a black background. And what that does, it serves to put the focus in the proper place. And what happens with a telephoto lens is that it narrows the field of view to where you're not looking at nearly as much, and then it narrows the depth of focus so that Only what you're focused on is in focus. Anything in the foreground, anything in the background is out of focus. So it serves to basically focus your mind and your eye on what is the important part of the subject. And so when I read this, and I think it's a point to be made, life which is viewed from the long lens, the telephoto lens, of God's perspective, it allows us to focus on what's important. And all of the distracting things are no longer in focus and no longer important to us. So God gives us that appropriate perspective that's lacking if God's not in the picture. And so, as a part of that, the second part of verse 11, it said He has put eternity in their hearts. That's the important thing to keep in mind. When you put it, look it through God's lens, then you're not overly burdened with the day-to-day aspects of this life. You're looking to eternity, and that's what's important, is eternity. So, I love the phrase that He has put eternity in their hearts. And we've made application of that phrase a couple of weeks ago by saying that with all of the efforts that have been made over the years to try to destroy faith in the minds of men, the intellectual elites of our age, educational elites, the government, all of those kinds of things, there have been forces actively working to replace God. Even ones when they say we don't want to do that, when they're advocating for atheistic evolution and different things like that, it's destructive to our faith, and people do lose their faith as a result of it. But when you look at the surveys about how many people still believe in God in our society, it's still by a large majority still do, despite all of the efforts that have been made by educators and such to basically destroy faith in God and to render religion to be considered superstitious and no longer applicable to our age. But men know that there's something out there, and men have that understanding. God's put it in their hearts, and it's very hard to dislodge that.
And they usually, I don't know where I read this, but most of them upon death acknowledge, you know, if there is a God, or that, okay, if you're out there, it's my time. And
a little too late there, huh? In that situation. But yeah, I mean, again, there's that. It's an agonizing thing when you reach the end of your life to consider that this was all that there was. You can rationalize, and you can convince yourself to one extent or another that there's more to life than what you've experienced up to this point. But when you get to the end of it, there's nothing left to experience. You still find out, well, there's something missing. And yeah, so I think even those who are avowed atheists. In fact, I was looking at a interview with a group of people where they were asking, "Are you an atheist?" And basically, young people at a university, and a lot of them said, "Yeah." Or, of course, you added it. Maybe many of them said they weren't, but the ones that they had on said, "Yes, I'm an atheist." And the question is, why? And he said, "Well, because it just seems to me there's insufficient evidence." Well, that may be atheism, but it's really more agnosticism. So I think there are a lot of people that say they're atheists that really are not atheists. They don't disbelieve in God. They doubt God's existence. And there's a difference. And when you get to the end of your life and you've lived your life vainly, then you start thinking, well, maybe there is more to this, or hopeful that there is more to this, although that's a misguided view as well. Because if you live your life as an atheist, you better hope there is no God, because if there is, you'll stand in judgment. But again, that's eternity is in our heart, and it's a natural thing to believe in God. But we do need to recognize that it is important for us to foster that faith. You have to work at it to grow, because Romans 1, Hebrews 5, all those other passages which detail either individuals who do not believe in God or those who have left the faith. It is a drifting. They no longer retain God in their knowledge, so God gave them over to a debased mind. Individuals who were in need again of being taught the first principles because they had not grown and gained the point where they could have solid food. So there is a digression. Your faith weakens and can eventually leave you if you do not foster it. but God puts eternity in our heart, and men know that. And it's an interesting thing he says here at the latter part of verse 11 in letter C, is that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. And the point that he makes here is that he makes us curious about the future, but not only does man have that eternal itch in the sense that God's in their heart and they're looking for something different, only man has that awareness of an end. That's one of the things that separates men from animals. There's no indication that animals contemplate or are aware of the fact that their life will end. It may be a pet where you could say, you know, they knew that they were going to die soon, and I think it's more likely that they just didn't feel good and they gave up. But man contemplates these things. He knows about death. He has the intellectual capability of recognizing that there's going to come a time when he returns to the earth. And man questions what's next. And that's a natural question to have. But it's something that only man does. Only man questions those things. He knows they're an end. He wants to know what that end is. And the only answer to that is in the perspective that God gives us. Okay? So God makes everything beautiful in its time, makes us curious about the future. But then the second part in verse 12 is that God gives. And this is another, I think, perspective that's found in the book. And it's also kept in keeping in mind the concept of ultimate vanity in the things that we do if God's not in the picture. So let's put God in the picture for a moment. So we talked about work. We've talked about gaining wisdom. We've talked about youth. We've talked about money. All of those kinds of things. Without God in the picture, all those things are vain. But now we know that God's in the picture. So what part should these things play in our lives? We talked about how there's nothing intrinsically wrong with gaining wealth. But the seeking after wealth, in other words, making that the priority of our lives, that's where the sin lies. We've talked about how it can be good to gain wisdom as long as our wisdom does not cause us to doubt the existence of God or His purposes. And I think that that's kind of the point of view he's giving here when he talks about this particular perspective in verse 12. He says, I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor. It is the gift of God. So here is where that comes in. You say, you know, work is vain. Well, then why should I work? Well, work is something that God has given you to do to accomplish things in this life. And work is something that gives us fulfillment. Work is something that's, if we have a job that we like, it's something that we enjoy. Work brings us money so that we can pay our bills and we can feed ourselves. So work is a good thing. So what should your attitude be toward work? Enjoy it. There's no use in you living your life miserably because you hate what you're doing. Find something that you can do and make a living that you enjoy, and then enjoy it. But understand this, that has nothing to do with eternity, and keep it in its proper place. And the same thing can be true with everything else that we've talked about at this point. The madness of mirth. Enjoy your life. You like to play golf, go play golf. You like to go fishing, go fishing. You like to sew, make sure you enjoy your sewing. Enjoy what it is that you're doing, but recognize it's not what life's about. Enjoy what you have. This is something God gives you and allows for you. But understand your responsibility is to serve Him and to live in accordance with His Word. If you keep that proper perspective, and God's the one that gives that perspective, then yes, you can enjoy your life as you live on this earth. And so that's, I think, an important point to make as well. And then the third one, I think there's three in this section, yes, is finally is God does. And the point of verses 14 and 15 is the permanency and perfection of God's work. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it. That men should fear before Him. That which is has already been, and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. So there are two points to be made in this. First of all, we talk about His work, the nature of His work, and that it brings us to have a proper respect for God. The firmament shows his handiwork. When we look at the earth and the world and the universe and how that we ourselves are fearfully and wonderfully made, when you contemplate everything that God has created and its perfection and completeness, it should cause you to be inspired and to be in awe. And he says here, everything he creates causes us to stand in silent respect. Now, there's something to be said for that, but I think that's actually not an entirely accurate statement. The statement I think more appropriately would read, everything that he creates should cause us to stand in silent respect. It should create in us that fear of God. I keep going back to Romans 1 because that's the antithesis of what we're talking about here. And you'll remember that the Apostle Paul there in that text said that these individuals who no longer retained him in their knowledge said that they had no knowledge of the eternal power in Godhead, and they are without excuse. By what he has made, his eternal power in Godhead are evident. It's obvious that there is a God. It's obvious the kind of creature or person that God is based upon his creation, and that he far surpasses our capabilities, our intelligence, our power. There needs to be respect there. And if an individual doesn't, he doesn't have an excuse. So for those who are right thinking, those who are willing to acknowledge truth, then yes, what God has done should cause us, or does cause us, to stand in silent respect. And the other thing, in the second part of this, which is found in verse 15, is he's done it over and over and over and over again. And he points out that one of the keys to learning in life is repetition. And so this cycle of life, the lessons are brought to bear time and time again. The amazing thing is how it is sometimes possible for people to see that cycle and witness that cycle and never learn the lesson. Shouldn't be that way, but it is. I remember the first time as a young preacher I came across this, and I think I've used this illustration before, so some of you may be familiar with it, but I was teaching in Tucumcari, New Mexico, and after I'd been there about a year, I was asked to teach the high school class. And it wasn't the first time I taught a high school class, but it was the first time I taught this group. And so I started off by kind of a survey, and I started asking just some fundamental questions. What must I do to be saved? These are Christians, young Christians. And how do we know the Bible is inspired? And different questions like that. And they couldn't answer it. They had absolutely no knowledge of it. And I got frustrated with them. And I basically kind of asked them and kind of got a dull-looking response to my question. But how is it that y'all can't at least be able to answer some of these questions? This is what I've been preaching on for a year. Here I'm up in the pulpit, and I'm bringing these lessons, and you've heard these things over and over and over again, and yet you don't act like this is the first time you're hearing them. And I wanted to ask the question further. How is it that you did what you're supposed to do to be saved, and now you can't say what it was that you was doing? That taught me an important lesson as a preacher is to never, and I want to say intelligence, but never overestimate your audience's knowledge and or attention. Because you can, in other words, it's necessary to spell it out fully. It's necessary to repeat yourself in order for some to get the lesson, because they're not paying as much attention as they should. But more to the point, when you look at life and every generation sees the generation before it die, or two generations before it die. When you're young, you see, if you may be old enough, I remember the death of my great-great aunt and uncle, as well as my great-grandmother. And then you get a little older, and your grandparents die, and you get a little older, and your parents start to die, and then, so now it's your turn. And what have you done? You've wasted your life, and you've lived in such a way as to think you're going to live forever. It's not going to happen to me. And don't recognize this cyclical nature of things. And it doesn't take much. We're told that those who refuse to learn history are doomed to repeat it. I think that's more true in the microcosm than the macro. In other words, we use that statement primarily to talk about how nations go to war again. But how can we expect the nations not to, to learn from the lessons and avoid the mistakes when we as individuals make the same mistakes over and over and over again? And so, that's, you know, that's something to keep in mind.
That just reminds me, too, that if all you're getting about the Lord and the Bible is that when you're at worship, then that's not enough. You've got to talk about it at home. You know, we always talk about lessons around the dinner table on Sundays and what if you understand or have any questions. And it's got to be constant in your life, not just on, you know, when you're in the building.
Yeah, osmosis isn't the best way to learn. It just doesn't seep in. You've got to engage yourself, that's for sure. Questions, comments about anything we've talked up to this point about? I know that didn't make sense, but talked about up to this point. All right, then we have just a couple of minutes left, and we get into the next point, which is on the top of page 14, and that is back to cynical Solomon. And so after that moment of insight and a few interesting things, he gets back to the despairing part. And so he says in verse 16, I saw under the sun in the place of judgment, wickedness was there in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. He said, I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. And I said in my heart, concerning the conditions of the sons of men, God test them, that they may see that they themselves are like animals. For what happens to the sons of men happens to animals. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they have all one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. Now that's one of the most despairing statements in the entire book in verse 19. But the interesting thing is, in the very next verse, or actually verse 21, it says, all goes to one place, all are from the dust, all return to the dust, having reference to the physical body. But then notice this question, who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirits of animals, which goes down to the earth? Who knows that? Now this is again, this intimation, is that there's something out there, there's something beyond. But a person who doesn't have an awareness of God doesn't know that. And that's the thing about the humanist. And this again is where this despair comes in. If you think about the individual who does not believe in God and thinks that man is the culmination of evolutionary process and we're the ones that make or break what this world is like, he gets to the end of his life. And the life that he lived is a life that ultimately is devoid of any great altering of human nature or the way things are. The cyclical nature of life continues. Then, in effect, when he's nearing death, he recognizes that when he dies, he's going to be just like Rover, just like the dog, because in his mind, he's just an animal. In his mind, since I'm dying and Rover's dying, that there's no advantage between me and him. That's a vain, vain thought, and that's ultimately where humanism gets you. Because that man who doesn't believe in God does not have that knowledge or belief that when an individual dies, his soul goes upward, whereas when a dog dies, it doesn't. And that's the distinction that is made there in verse 21. But in the passage, when he asks the question, who knows this? The answer is the man who does not have, who's living under the sun, he doesn't have that knowledge. And so I perceive, verse 22, that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? So here is, again, there's some interspersing of insight in this, but here's this despairing Solomon again when he talks about the injustice of life. There in verse 16 of the text, that in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity. He gives us, his, and Wilson Adams in this book has a tendency to do this, give you some kind of obvious examples to bring your mind to it. A reckless driver runs a red light and almost causes a wreck, and we ask, you know, where's a police officer when you need him? And you wonder about that. Where are all these police officers? Yeah, you see them all the time, but then when actually something like this is happening, they're not nowhere around. And that's kind of our raging against the injustice of a particular situation. If we thought about it, we'd understand that there's only so many policemen, and you know, it's the chances that they'll be there at that particular time pretty small. But that doesn't change the fact that this is an unjust thing happening, and it's not fair. When people act that way and eat in wickedness and evil prospers, it's not a fair thing. And so that's one of the things that makes life vain. And that's the problem is injustice. Injustice exists all through society. He mentions not only that, the latter part of verse 21 with regard to... latter part of verse 16, where he says that in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. But also in the first part of that verse, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. So, in other words, okay, now you have an individual who, for whatever reason, is put on the justice seat because of some iniquity that he's done, and then you have a judge that lets him off. Or you have a judge that punishes righteousness instead of punishing wickedness like you're supposed to. So when you look to men to basically solve the injustice, to right the inequity, it's not going to happen. And that's why righteous people suffer, because there is wickedness that is prevalent in the land. Always has been, always will be. And as a result of that, the answer, of course, is under B, is eternal hope in verse 17 of the text. And that is, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. And that's where that solution is to be found. Okay, let's pick up there and talk a little bit more with the conclusion, that is, the solution being eternal hope, in our discussion next week. And then that will allow us, what day will that be? It'll be the
first.
It'll be the first, okay. Okay, and what that will do is allow us to get through that and the discussion questions, and probably into chapter 4, lesson 4. I don't think that the remainder of this will take the entire class. So finish up that, put some things together for the discussion questions, if anything comes to mind, and then start looking at chapter 4, lesson 4. All right. Appreciate everyone's attention today.